I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, Anthony Klotz, was at a conference in Chicago a while back and discovered, unbeknownst to him, that three colleagues were interviewing for jobs at other universities. He thought, like him, they loved where they worked. That event got him thinking maybe he was being foolish, not pursuing openings at other schools, and so he did. As it turns out, his colleagues decided to stay put while he took an academic position he had previously turned down. He calls this unexpected event that got him to reevaluate his relationship with his job a jolt. He says these inflection points are more common than we think. His new book, Jolted, Why We Quit, When to Stay, and Why It Matters, details the many kinds of jolts we can experience on the job, how to interpret them, and how to handle them. Anthony Klotz is an organizational psychologist with a long-standing interest in why people quit. In 2021, when we were coming out of the worst of the pandemic, he coined the phrase the Great Resignation to describe why so many people were leaving their jobs. He's a professor of organizational behavior at UCL School of Management in London, and he joins us today on The Connection. Anthony Klotz, nice to have you with us on the show.
It's wonderful to be here, Marty.
Well, let's start with you, since I started with you in my introduction. So what got you rethinking what kind of job you wanted to be doing?
Yeah, I certainly wasn't ready for it. Or when that day started, I had no intentions of rethinking what I wanted to be doing or where I wanted to be working. And it was really this realization that three of my close colleagues were thinking of leaving that had this sudden effect on me, that not only would I be foolish not to consider it as well, but also thinking about if those three leave, my relationship with my current job is going to change quite a bit. Like, those are three of my friends, and if they're not there, my satisfaction with my overall day-to-day is going to go down. And in addition, if those three left, I would probably have to pick up more work for a little while. And as many of us know, when we have to replace a colleague. And then finally, it's the curiosity of where are they going? Is the grass greener on these other sides that they're looking at? So for those different types of reasons, you know, turnover contagion came for me that day, for sure. And it caused me to start looking and surprise myself by leaving a job that I liked.
Was that a kind of aha experience? I think many people have had that, myself included, where all of a sudden something looks different, feels different.
Yep. It was a classic aha moment where the feeling that I had, if you would have asked me that morning or that prior week, did I have any intention of leaving? Could I see myself leaving? I would have said no. And after that aha moment, it turned to maybe.
And how soon after that aha moment did you actually leave?
So it would have been a couple months later. So I took a minute to process those feelings and then reach back out and test the market. And a couple months later to do an interview. But I when I did that interview, which was traveling to this other university, they gave me an offer that next day. And I accepted the day after that. So that was also like very quick how my feelings had changed.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about what you coined as the Great Resignation. I realize it was a kind of throwaway line on your part, but nonetheless, it really stuck, and we still use it today. Going back 5-6 years after the start of the pandemic, and then as we came out of the pandemic, how much do you think that has reordered how people work, how people think about their job?
Yeah, I think that the pandemic has had a permanent impact on our relationship with work. And it may not be seismic, but it's definitely significant. And so it's not just my feeling. There is some evidence that the percentage of individuals who would keep working if they didn't have to dropped as a result of the pandemic and has not come up since. And so there's this indication that millions of individuals, how they feel about work has changed. And you could extrapolate that to how they feel about their jobs as well.
I wonder, and there were millions of people that either entirely left the workforce or left their job, obviously looking for a different kind of work. I wonder, like, how are they doing today? What are they doing today? Because most of us need to work. We need the money.
Yeah, and Part of that, I believe, was, a misconception of my using the word resignation. I think a lot of individuals thought that the prediction was that all these individuals were permanently leaving the workforce. There was another popular term, reshuffling, and I thought, yeah, that's a good term too. Like, a lot of individuals were switching to other jobs. And so a lot of people switched careers, switched jobs within the same industry, took a career break, and then got back in because, the years after 2021, 2022, 2023, those were really strong job markets. And so you can imagine a lot of individuals finding the careers they want, the jobs they want. And I'll be honest, it's popped back up recently. A number of the layoffs that have happened have part of the reason that companies have given for these layoffs have been that we overhired back in 2022, 2023. We got too excited coming out of the pandemic during the Great Resignation and overhired, and now we're right-sizing a little bit. So whether that's true or not, these layoff explanations are always interesting. There is this notion that the people moved around quite a bit then.
It's interesting to think of that time because it feels as if workers, employees had the kind of clout to leave their job and perhaps find a new job, that the power was more in the hands of workers than it is today. Is that true?
That's completely true. Workers had much more power in 2022 and 2023 than they do now. The labor market right now is largely frozen. I think the term that people are using to describe it the most is a low hire, low fire environment. Not many, relatively few people are quitting. Relatively few people are being laid off or fired, despite the headlines. But there's not a lot of new job openings out there. That can be completely contrasted with the Great Resignation days, where there was not a lot of firing, but a lot of new hiring, a lot of jobs, and a lot of people switching jobs and getting pay raises as a result of that.
Some of your research asks the lottery question, that if you won the lottery, won big, would you work or would you quit? Walk us through that question, what that reveals.
Yeah, and I was inspired to look into this question. During that 2022, 2023 Great Resignation period, workers had so much power that a number of business owners were putting signs on their doors saying, "We're closed today because no one wants to work anymore." And I thought, does no one want to work anymore? How do we even study that question? Conveniently, since 1972, every 2 years, there's been a survey in the US that's asked a number of questions, but one of the questions it asks is exactly what you said, the lottery question. Essentially, if you struck it rich, if you didn't need money anymore, you could live as comfortably as you wanted, would you keep working or would you no longer work? And it's always interesting to have people guess, like, what percentage of Americans would keep working? And it's around 70%. Now, it's fluctuated a little bit, but since 1972, it's been fairly flat as a board. 7 out of 10 Americans say, even if I struck it rich and didn't need my paycheck, I would keep working, which is kind of a nice vote for how people feel about the value of work in their lives. Now, I left out a few of the most recent years of the survey. What's interesting is the last year before the pandemic, that number was 72% of Americans. In 2018, 72% of Americans said they would keep working even if they didn't need to. And then the survey wasn't done in 2020 because of the pandemic. It was done in 2021, and the number came back and it was 62%. It had dropped 10 points, which equates to millions of Americans now saying, I wouldn't keep working if I struck it rich. And keep in mind, this survey, 2021, 2022, these are really strong job markets post-pandemic. And still you have this large percentage of people who now say they wouldn't continue working. And so that shows that in even 2024, the most recent survey, it's still down in the mid to low 60s. And so that's where this, like, permanent shift in how people feel about work seems to be reflected. And so the majority of people still want to work, and would keep working even if they didn't have to. But it's changed. And part of what I started asking based on I asked this question of audiences a lot: what percentage of you would keep working even if you didn't have to because you hit the lottery? And it's often around 70%. But one person said one day, ask the same question, but ask how many of us would keep working at our current job if
Exactly.
we won the lottery.
Right.
And
And
the hands drop down to 10 or 20%. And so, I think we don't have historical data on that question, but I would guess that's really dropped as a result of the pandemic. So, Yeah, that sort of captures the shift in Americans' perceptions about work.
I'm thinking that the majority of people that do want to work, there are so many things though that you do get from work, a sense of identity. When people ask you, well, what do? You have an answer for them. They're the relationships that you get at work. And, we spend more time if you're on the job in, at the actual workplace. We spend hours and hours with people who are maybe not considered friends or family, but nonetheless, we spend a lot of time with them. And it's our tribe. People are social. We want to be part of a community of people that are kind of rowing in the same direction.
Yeah, at its best, work can fulfill all of our fundamental human needs. Our needs to be in connection with other people, like you mentioned, our need for meaning and purpose and doing something meaningful with our life, and just our need for day-to-day happiness, our need for new challenges. These all can be met at work when it's at its best. That's a pretty big caveat, though, because it's often not.
I often think that we also bring our habits and even our relationships from our family to the workplace, so that all of a sudden the boss becomes the stand-in for the parent that we have fought our whole life against. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, we're comfortable with, we grow up often in these family structures and become comfortable with them, and they are sort of mimicked by the workplace. And this can sometimes be contentious. There's a number of leaders out there who actively cultivate this notion that the workplace is a family. We are a family here. And that's really comforting to a lot of employees because even though family doesn't always have positive connotations for all of us, for many people it does, and it conveys this sense of security and I'm going to be taken care of. I can make mistakes and I'm not going to be kicked out. This is a nice environment, and I think this is especially true in small businesses, but large businesses as well. The challenge with that family notion is, of course, the workplace is not really a family, and if you do make mistakes, you can be asked to leave and not come back. And so, where a lot of this tension has come from is when there's layoffs in an organization where it's been said that we're all one family. The jolting effects of those layoffs are much stronger because I thought this was family-like, and now you're like pulling away my siblings or my parent, and that can be jarring.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Anthony Klotz. He's an organizational psychologist and he's written a brand new book. It's titled Jolted: Why We Quit, When to Stay, and Why It Matters. And we have been talking about the work environment, the workplace, what we get from work, and we'll be talking more about why we leave and what drives us out and what pulls us out. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with organizational psychologist Anthony Klotz, who says that most of us are one event away from leaving our job. All it takes is a jolt to get us to rethink our relationship with our work. And he's got a new book called, not surprisingly, Jolted. So if we are one event away from quitting, from leaving our job, that does speak to this kind of dissatisfaction, I guess, that many people have when going to work, when doing the job that's at hand.
Yeah, in some ways it can speak to dissatisfaction, but it also indicates that we often see individuals who quit jobs that they're happy with, that they're not dissatisfied with. And in a moment like right now, we're also seeing like lots of individuals who are highly dissatisfied with their jobs, and you would say they'll certainly quit, but they don't. And so, what jolts help explain are sort of these these unexpected moments where people quit jobs that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to. And the same goes with staying.
You have an anecdote of a woman whose boss insulted her daughter, I think insulted her, and then her daughter, and she literally just packed her bags and walked out the door. I mean, I completely understand why she might want to do that. There probably were problems anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. There may have been underlying issues, but in this case, it was just this one event that all of a sudden led to this impulsive quitting. Set my keys on the desk and walk out. And we usually discount these types of events when we think about why do employees leave. So it's often we think of the employee who's disgruntled and slowly over time they come to the realization, I don't want to be here anymore. But often what we find, it's actually these events that all of a sudden trigger someone who otherwise wouldn't leave to do so.
You talk about the different kind. There's six types of jolts. One, direct, which I think we can understand, which is this, perhaps this woman that upped and left her job. What's a collateral jolt? What does that mean? Where does that come from?
Yeah, so the direct jolts are the ones that happen directly to us, whereas collateral jolts are when somebody else in our sphere is jolted or has a major event that sort of reverberates and causes us to reflect on our relationship with work too. And so turnover contagion, which we talked about earlier, is one of the best examples of this, where one of our coworkers decides to leave. Of course, that's going to make us, even if we're happy, think about leaving. Another type of collateral jolt that's interesting that often gets discounted in organizations is when you're a third party or a witness to your boss abusing a coworker. And you might think, why would that affect you? You're not the one in the firing line there. But research is increasingly showing that it's just as impactful to be a witness to abuse in the workplace as being the receiver of abuse, because we often think, well, it's only a matter of time before we're going to be next. And it's also really unpleasant, often more unpleasant than being treated poorly ourselves, is to see someone else who we care about being treated poorly. So that can be a collateral jolt as well.
Because they're a colleague and we have a relationship with them, right?
Yeah, it goes back to this notion of family, or like that a lot of our relational needs can be met at work. We have these tight connections with other individuals. And again, even if we don't necessarily have the close connection with this coworker, it still makes us think it's only a matter of time before I'm on the receiving end of that.
What's a honeymoon jolt?
Yeah, honeymoon jolts. Not that I have favorites, but yeah, these are definitely okay. some of my favorites, because it leads to this. You know, I was surprised when I learned that the most common year for quitting in your career is year one. So almost the majority of turnover happens in this first year with employees who often struggle to adjust to the new job. And so honeymoon jolts are these moments within our first year in a new job where the expectations we had, and it could be around how much vacation time we had, it could be around pay, it could be around how we're treated. All of a sudden we have this moment where we realize what I thought was going to happen in this new job is not happening. And then the feeling of regret comes in. Not necessarily the feeling of regret that you've left your old job, but the feeling of regret that you've taken this new one, maybe under false pretenses. And I don't mean to make it sound like the company led you astray, although that sometimes happens. But in the job search process, in the recruitment process, we're putting our best foot forward. You know, they're getting the best version of Anthony possible. And the company is also putting its best foot forward. So these unrealistic expectations are sometimes set that lead us, sort of set us up to come in a honeymoon in this new job. I think it's going to be fantastic. And then it quickly becomes more of a hangover.
It's a jolt. Is that, how much is that an emotional response where you just feel something so powerfully that it really changes your perception of the work that you're doing?
It's very often the first experience that you have is an emotional experience. And that signals to us something is different here. Something is worthy of my attention. And that's sort of when the cognitive side kicks in and says, why do we have this strong emotional reaction? And we think about it. And sometimes we think about it. And of course, we realize we reacted strongly, but it's not that big of a deal, or time heals some wounds. But sometimes we think about it and we say, wait, there's a problem here. There's a fundamental problem with my relationship with this job, with work, and maybe I just need to get away from it right away, or maybe there's something I can do to change it. and I can take some action.
But can we trust our emotions? I mean, yes, we are cognitive thinking people. We also have deep feelings about experiences and people.
Yeah, I think emotions are great and can be instructive, but I wouldn't trust fully trust our emotions, and that's part of why I say, like, in the wake of jolts, like, what's the best first action to take, like, immediately, right away? I often say nothing, just sitting with it for a while and letting the emotions subside, and then really testing to see if you can trust that emotion, to see if there's information behind it, or to just see if it's a, you know, maybe it's a bad day or it's an off day, and the emotional reaction we had was valid in the moment, but it's not indicative of some underlying fissure in our relationship with work.
I would imagine that most people know what we're talking about and have experienced some version of a jolt. But I also think that most people probably stay in jobs that they may not love, maybe jobs that they even hate. And the jolts are a reminder it's not a good fit. But what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, so it's different. I mean, what are you going to do about it is the key question. And it's different for each person. And part of what I think is important to acknowledge is a lot of us, either for our entire careers in sad cases, or definitely for all of us in parts of our career, we're stuck in the place that we are. We don't have other job options because of the location of our job. It's good for our family, so we can't just up and leave, whatever it may be. And so part of what is important to do in the wake of a jolt is be really honest with yourself and probably talk to your partner or your close friends and go through what options you do have. And you may have none, in which case you might say, all right, then I need to do what I can to sort of minimize the negative effects of this job on me. But you probably have more options than you think. And, you know, one of the big options that a lot of us don't use is just speaking up and trying to change the situation that we're in, because we assume our boss isn't going to be open to this change or whatever it may be. And so I do think it's useful in the wake of a jolt to be honest with yourself and maybe even gather some evidence to say, how stuck am I? Or do I have options or do I not? If you do, great. If not, then you adjust accordingly.
Let me ask you more about speaking up, but let me just first quickly reintroduce you. That's Anthony Klotz, our guest today on The Connection, and he's got a brand new book. It's called Jolted, Why We Quit, When to Stay, and Why It Matters. He's a professor of organizational behavior at UCL School of Management in London. I mentioned this earlier, but I'll just repeat it. He coined the phrase the Great Resignation when we saw so many people leaving their jobs as we were beginning to come out of the pandemic. You talk about speaking up, and speaking up is hard. Speaking up is hard at work. There's often blowback, but you say don't speak up unless you've got some people skills here, and I'll just list what you write. Are you good at sensing other people's emotions and agendas? Is it easy for you to get people to like you? Are you good at projecting sincerity when you communicate with others? Are you good at using your connections and network to get things done at work? Because some people can speak up and then anger everybody in the room, and some people know how to navigate these difficult terrains.
Yeah, being honest with yourself, asking yourself those questions to determine, do I have political skill or do I not? Am I able to speak up in a way that doesn't make me sound obnoxious or like a problem? I could speak up in a way to make it sound like more of a solution, or there's an opportunity here for my boss that they can capitalize on. And this is an individual difference, and there's nothing wrong with being low political skill. Just there is something wrong if you're low political skill and you don't get some guidance and really prepare before speaking up. For those with high political skill, it comes a little bit easier to them.
It's interesting you call it political skill. I call it personal skills, but I guess it's one and the same, right?
It's conceptually the same. I like your term better. I'm using, I guess, the term we have in our literature, which isn't as probably useful. Yeah, they're more human skills than it's how you can navigate politics in the workplace, but that's a more negative spin on it than yours.
You also say there's the option of carrying on, which is basically just doing what you're doing, but maybe being a better actor at it. Dig into that for us.
Yeah, so I'm, you know, like I was saying, at different points in our career, we're stuck. And you know, I talk about the story of Michelle Obama for a while when she realized, hey, I'm a high-powered, high-paid lawyer, but I want to do something with more impact, but I don't know what that is yet. And she kind of hung out for like 6 months while she was job searching, still doing her job really, really well, but staying put. And so often in the wake of a jolt, you realize I need to make a change, but I don't need to make it right now. And so how do I make right now tolerable? And it has to do with this concept that's called deep acting, which is really thinking about the parts of your job that you don't like and say, how can I think about these in a little bit more positive way? And one of the easiest ways to do this is to try to think of like, how is, you know, whatever difficult task that I'm doing that I don't want to do at all, how is this providing some growth for me? Even if it's like, you know, you can think of like the most annoying task in the workplace, like fixing the copy machine or something like that.
Indeed.
Instead of getting upset, thinking like, well, I am acquiring some skills, you know, I'm using a different side of my brain for this part of the day. So it is a little bit like mental trickery, but it does work, changing your mindset to this more growth-oriented, this more positive mindset, and really changing the way you feel about the job tasks that you don't like. Research is clear that it leads to lower exhaustion and lower burnout, but you probably can't do that forever.
Fake it till you make it. I mean, is that another way to think about it?
That's another way to think about it. But again, this is deep acting. So it's kind of like a deep fake, as opposed to just, we have this other type of acting we do, like when our boss tells an inappropriate joke and we feel like we have to just kind of act and laugh along with it. This is actually trying to change the way that we feel about the tasks deep down inside, which is better, but tougher to do.
There's another response you write about called a leaning back, also sounding a lot like quiet quitting, which is hear your responsibilities and you sort of focus on the ones that you care about and try to sort of bury the ones that are less fulfilling. Can we really do that on the job and get away with it?
We often can. It depends on the situation, but I think it's being really clear about what are the core elements of my job? What is my performance evaluation really based on? And not leaning back or slacking off on those tasks. That's the core of your job. But often through this process called job creep, our job grows over the years much bigger than what we signed up for to begin with. And some of that creep and that growth are tasks that don't really add value to us, may not even add value to the organization. They can be easily delegated, or they can be stopped. You know, you just stop doing them and nobody notices. And so
Wow.
it is, you know, quiet quitting is all about thinking about these extra tasks that we do and why are we doing that extra? So why don't we act our wage and you know, do a little bit less? So this is being a little bit smart about it and saying, what are these tasks that are not very visible, that aren't helping me in my career, that might not be missed if they're gone? And lean back from those. And it's really an act of self-preservation. It's about saying, I need to somehow rebalance the resources I'm putting into work and what I'm getting back out of it. Otherwise, burnout is there, and that's not going to be good for the organization or myself. And so, yeah, leaning back can be great. And I think we are in this era of, you know, we're back glorifying hustle culture again. And I like the notion that, like, for even for high performers, leaning back is an option when you find yourself in a situation where work isn't working for you.
I want to underscore something you said there about acting your wage, you know, which is obviously a play on acting your age, but acting your wage, which is this is what my job, this is what I get paid for, and this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And it's sometimes, you know, that term is frowned upon, and people will say, well, you're never going to get promoted.
Right.
You're never going to move up in your career if you just act your wage. And I somewhat agree. Like, if you're looking to make it to the executive suite or to soar up in the organization, typically you do have to give much more of yourself than most of us would probably want to the organization in exchange for those promotions. But the reality is at many different points in our careers, we're happy with a plateau for a while, especially if our well-being is being stretched because we've got demands outside of work, because we've got things inside of work that are overwhelming. And in those demanding stretches of our career and our lives, it makes complete sense, again, for the sustainability of ourselves and work, to act our wage, to just say, For this moment, the exchange relationship between work and myself is going to be equal. I'm going to put in this and I'm going to get back out that same amount. And I think most managers would agree that, yeah, during different points of your career, that makes sense. Again, this is a give and take relationship.
You reference what we often refer to as job creep, the idea that that work doesn't end at five. It's bleeding over into after dinner and before going to bed. But I was also thinking that Americans are notorious about not taking the vacations that they are owed. And I wonder whether we do things that don't help us feel better about ourselves and our work and give us some time off.
Yeah. And that's been, a few years ago, I moved to the UK and, people's attitudes about vacation are very different than what I'm used to.
Anyone in Europe, right.
And in a much healthier and more productive way, I would say. And the research is really, really clear that taking time, these chunks of time off from work, not one day at a time, but 2 weeks in a chunk is really, really good for resetting your resources and for fighting burnout and so forth. And, there's also research that shows that a lot of the benefits of vacation go away if you work on vacation. And again, the out of office assistants that I see here in Europe are very different than the ones I often see in the US. Often in the US, it's like, in case of emergency, you can reach me. not as much, I don't think, in other parts of the world, because being reached by work while you're on vacation gets rid of a lot, it takes your mind out of the state that it's in. It brings work into your vacation, and the benefits for your company and for yourself of that time away goes away.
We're almost up on a break here, but do you think people are happier in the UK where you are because of these policies?
That's a question. I don't have data to see it, but I could say, are people happier with work-life balance and with their holidays? Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Anthony Klotz. He's an organizational psychologist. In fact, he is professor of organizational behavior at UCL School of Management, which is in London. And we've been talking about his new book. It's titled Jolted: Why We Quit, When to Stay, and Why It Matters. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Anthony Klotz about something he calls jolts. These are unexpected events that get us to rethink our relationship with our work. We are told that our careers are largely the result of planning. Klotz says that jolts play a surprisingly significant role. And again, his book is called Jolted. Let me ask you about another kind of jolt that feels like it's happening right now in the world, which is wars, economic conflicts, things that we have absolutely no control of, but are obviously impacting the world that we live in. And for many people, I think their jobs as well.
Yeah, these remote jolts may be the most overlooked form of jolts, because we think, an event that happens halfway around the world that doesn't impact us directly. We just hear about it on our phones. We see it on the news. How could that really lead us to question our relationship with work? But increasingly, science is showing that indeed, when these events happen, especially if they involve tragedy or death, it naturally makes us think big thoughts about life. Right. But death calls to mind, am I living the life that I want to live? A big part of that comes from work. As you mentioned earlier, a big part of our identity comes from work. And so when we have that sort of reflection, which went on a lot during the pandemic and we had time to do it, often the outcome of that reflection is, no, I want to make a change. And often that change is in the workplace. And so the connection between a distant event and changes to the job I'm doing actually isn't as far apart as you might think.
Well, let's talk about resignations. How do you suggest people prepare to exit a job they have decided to leave?
Yeah, so I tend to break resignations down into three phases: this pre-resignation period, then actually announcing the resignation itself, and then you've got the notice period often, and the transition period afterwards. So it is realizing that planning helps, that this pre-resignation period is an opportunity to say, what's my game plan here? Who do I want to tell? What relationships do I want to retain? What is the goal? And am I resigning in a Is my reason for resignation something that the company is going to take as a threat? So if you're going to go work for the rival and competitor, then be prepared potentially to be escorted out as soon as you say, I'm quitting. If you're leaving to go back to grad school, that's a much less threatening reason for resigning. So really thinking about how am I going to communicate this? And then when it comes to actually giving your resignation notice, in most cases, the best policy is to tell your boss first, as tempting as it would be to tell coworkers or your friends. If it gets back to your boss, it will often result in a more negative resignation than you probably intend. And one interesting caveat or piece here is that it's best to tell your boss face to face or video chat. Increasingly, people feel like it's okay to resign via some sort of email or messaging, and it happens quite a bit. And my research shows that obviously you can do it that way, but it's received much more negatively by your boss or by HR than in a face-to-face meeting. So making sure in that resignation that you give your reason for resigning, have a face-to-face conversation, and then give some thought to how disruptive is me leaving going to be? Like, what problems is it going to cause? And what could I do within reason to mitigate that damage? And even if you're leaving on, in your mind, a sour note, there's almost never anything to be gained by letting that sourness out during the resignation. So this is where it involves some surface acting often, and to keep a smile on your face, go a little bit above and beyond, because these relationships matter even after you leave.
You say an interesting thing, though, that even if we don't say that we're leaving, we don't tell our colleagues that we're leaving, and we wait to tell our boss, that often our colleagues know that something is up. Something looks and feels different.
Yeah, this is some of my favorite research on pre-quitting signals or pre-quitting behaviors. And we often think, I haven't told anybody, or maybe I've just told my family, so there's nobody at work who knows that I'm thinking about leaving. But it turns out we're often sending signals that we're not aware of, that we're thinking about quitting. And the most obvious, there are some signals like, you know, going online and checking your 401k balance or asking HR about it. But those aren't the big ones. The more subtle ones are that you're quieter in meetings, because you realize, like, in your head, you're like, I'm not going to be here in the future. And so I don't need to chime in on this strategic plan or whatever it may be, but that's a behavioral change for you. And so once, when I was quitting a job, one of the very first people I told, who hadn't heard it from anybody else, said, I said, hey, I have some news to tell you. And they responded, you're quitting, aren't you? And I said, how would you have possibly known that? And they said, I just noticed the last month, all of a sudden, you've been much quieter in meetings. And so I just thought you're backing away. And of course, my thought was, well, why didn't you ask me why I was being quiet? Like, they were a close colleague. But it just goes to show that, like, most of us do withdraw a bit as we think of, as we're in this pre-resignation process.
You mentioned the grateful goodbye, as you say, when you tell your boss. But if you're leaving, why does that matter? Why should we do that in a personable kind of way?
Yeah, the grateful goodbye, giving a little bit more notice perhaps than you need to, just to make your transition easier on the organization, and expressing gratitude, thinking about what the company's done for you, expressing gratitude. You don't need to do that. So why would you? Well, you know, the social capital that you build on your way out, the strengthening of relationships, it turns out it pays off later in your career. Not only, you know, you may be thinking, yes, my profession is a small field, so I can see how it would help me in that regard. So for sure. But the another reason is because boomerang employment is becoming more common. So we talked about earlier these honeymoon jolts where you go into a new job and you think this is going to be fantastic. It turns out not to be fantastic. And so those honeymoon jolts are a good reason why leaving on the best note possible potentially opens the door to you coming back, which at the time you might think, I don't want to do that. I'll never come back. But you'll be surprised at how much your feelings about your prior organization change with a little bit of time in the rearview mirror. And it may be, why not keep that door potentially cracked open?
I would assume managers talk to each other too. They go to conferences and they talk about difficult employees, so word might get out.
Absolutely. Word might get out. And any manager and any of us, like if we think about who is the type of employee that we would like to hire, who's the type of person who we would like to work with? Somebody who left in a disgruntled way from their prior job, or somebody who left in a really jovial, positive way, saying good things about their prior employer. I'd rather work with that second person. And so yeah, so managers talking, why would you resign in a way that limits your potential future in any way? There's maybe a few good reasons to do it, but in general, resigning in as positive a way as possible has a nice payoff in the future.
Are managers generally surprised when someone sits down and has a meeting with them and tells them, I've got a new job and I'm going to be leaving?
Managers get no training for how to handle when an employee resigns. And
Really?
especially if you're a good, if you're a pretty good performer, if you're a high performer, it's really a gut punch. And you know, so as a manager, you think, I'm losing a really good employee. We're all familiar with the phrase, people don't leave companies, they leave leaders. And so as a leader, you're thinking, oh my gosh, like they're leaving because of me. So you feel insecure about that. So this ball of emotions leads managers to react in all sorts of ways to resignations. And so I hear lots of resignation stories, and you get manager responses, you know, from the whole spectrum of being happy and laughing and saying good, like see you later, to crying, to getting really angry, to begging you to stay,
Wow.
to all these different types of reactions. And so one thing I recommend with organizations is to provide some training and prepare managers for this. But in many ways, I always, you know, when I was a manager and one of my employees told me they were leaving, it not only surprised me, but it felt like getting dumped, honestly.
Wow.
And, you know, it's tough to stay in the moment and be constructive and professional in those situations. And so, yeah, as employees, you know, it's if you're going to resign as an individual, you know, be prepared for, you know, unexpected reactions from your manager and your organization.
But does it tell us that managers don't really know what's going on in their employees' heads? I mean, maybe they're not entitled to know how people feel about their job or their colleagues or even their boss, but that there's a gap there.
Absolutely. And there is a gap, and I'm going to say it's not necessarily the manager's fault. You know, organizations largely reward managers for focusing on operational success, not on relationship success. And so where do managers devote most of their time? It's to the tasks that keep whatever processes flowing that are the key part of the business. There's less incentives for them to really understand how their workers are experiencing work and life. And so that's where these surprises come in. If you're paying attention and you have the bandwidth to pay attention, which many managers don't, you can pick up on these jolts when they happen. You can see that an employee is withdrawing, that they're stressed, that their behavior has changed, and then you can ask them about it and you have the time to listen to their response. But a lot of middle managers who are listening, you know, don't have that time to dedicate to relationships and listening. And that's really not their fault. It's a problem with the structure of the managerial job.
And the impulse is when you hear that someone is unhappy that you're supposed to fix it, make it better. And I think for a lot of probably middle managers, they're stuck in the middle between the higher ups and the people that they manage.
Yeah, it's a uniquely challenging role because you don't have much power and you don't necessarily have the power to fix problems. But you do hear all of the problems that employees, that your frontline workers are having. Now, that being said, I do think managers often have more power than they think to make some small changes to workers' jobs to make them better, but they don't necessarily feel empowered to do that.
Sometimes it just feels good to have someone listen to someone to one's complaints, though, don't you think?
It feels good to have someone listen to our complaints, to listen to how we're experiencing life and work. And it really feels good to have someone notice that our behavior has changed. Or even if they're wrong, right? So they're like, I think you're withdrawing a bit, Anthony. And I actually wasn't thinking it. It's still nice that they're paying attention to me and noticed and asked, right? I mean, we all want to be cared about. And that goes for the workplace as well as outside the workplace. So, yes.
You describe a kind of a meeting or event for you where you had to hear a lot of criticism about the way that you were doing your job. And I applaud you for not only doing this, but also including it in your book. And the criticism was that you were a micromanager. Was that a surprise to you?
I don't know that it was a complete surprise, but it was a surprise to me how universally despised it that my engagement in micromanagement was by the team. It was a complete 100% rejection of my management style. And
Wow.
so I kind of thought, sure, they don't love everything I'm doing, but it's working. They see the silver lining here. But the reality that they showed me was no part of this is working whatsoever. You are not being a good leader right now.
What did you do with that information?
Well, this was very early in my career, and I was still, like I'd say, fairly malleable as a leader. And so I changed, and thankfully, I was partnered up with another manager who had a lot more experience and was flat out a better manager and a better person than me. And so I was able to, he kind of took me under his wing, and I shadowed him and just saw how he interacted with his employees and how I was interacting with my workers. And it comes back to what we were just talking about, listening, to where I would ask employees, how is the line going? What's happening in their work? We were on a
Right.
manufacturing line. And he would ask, how's life? What's
Oh,
going
wow.
on? How are the kids? And inevitably it would come back to work, of course, but he was able to, one, they knew he cared about them. He was listening to them. And if they had been jolted by something, he would pick up on it through their responses. Whereas I was just focused on production and my workers could see that I didn't care about them. I cared about performance. So it took a while, and I would say it wasn't like I was in that role for 6 more months, and I wouldn't say I did this like amazing turnaround. I got better, but it took a lot more time to really get better.
Did you like yourself better as a manager as a result of this?
Of course. I mean, I liked myself better, but it was difficult and it challenged some of my notions of how to manage well. And I grew up in a family business that had sort of set my mind around the relationship between leaders and followers, and that there were boundaries there that you don't really cross and that you don't need to get in your employees' personal lives. And so it was uncomfortable for me, and it required me to challenge and rewire some of the ways that I thought the world of management and leadership should work. But yes, absolutely. It's so much more fun to be a leader when you have deep personal connections with your workers, when they care about you and you care about them, and you can be real instead of just being the tough manager.
Final question. You have been setting resignations for a lot of your professional life. Why have you made this your life's work?
So resignations to me, I started studying it because I realized that when I was a worker, I didn't do a very good job of resigning. And when I was a manager, I didn't know how to respond to it. And so it was one of those areas where you looked around and I looked up how many people were searching the internet for how do I quit a job? What's the best way to quit a job? And so it's this thing that we don't really talk about in organizations, how to quit, when to quit, why to quit. But it's something that we all experience multiple times in our career. And one lasting piece of gratitude I have for the Great Resignation is that elevated the conversation of quitting to something a little bit more normal than it was before. And I hope my research continues to do that in the future.
Well, Anthony Klotz, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for writing this book and for joining us today on The Connection.
Absolutely. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Jolted: Why We Quit, When to Stay, and Why It Matters. And our guest, Anthony Klotz, is an organizational psychologist. In fact, a professor of organizational behavior at UCL School of Management, which is in London. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. And I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.